Nisambula Vinaka. This is Tangata Oti Moana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Kuroi Hawkins. Coming up, a Bougainville freedom fighter is sworn in as president of the autonomous PNG region.
I will utilize the best brains available inside and outside Bougainville.
Vanuatu considers creating a new passport for its honorary citizens.
Sort of an economic passport, but it gives the effect of citizenship that is prescribed under the constitution.
Frontline workers in New Zealand are seeing improvements in the Pacifica mental health space, and a Solomon's academic says China's development grants to his country could signal change. Bougainville's fourth president, Ishmael Toroama, has been sworn in this week. The former freedom fighter was declared president-elect on Wednesday after he overcame the challenge of 24 other candidates in an election race that started 7 weeks ago. Don Wiseman has more.
Ishmael Toroama became a fighter for the separatist Bougainville Revolutionary Army at the age of 19, back at the beginning of the Civil War. He won a reputation as one of the most feared men on Bougainville. But after the ceasefire in 1997, and when he became commander of the BRA, he turned peacemaker. Mr. Toroama took part in the various peace talks and was one of the signatories of the peace agreement in 2001. He worked to bring peace, to foster the surrender of weapons and the reconciliation of former warring groups. He stood for Parliament in 2005 and for President in 2015 before winning this week.
The winds of change has blown. It has arrived at your doorsteps. All over Bougainville, people have voted for new leaders. I will lead this new group of vibrant leaders to first of all complete the key unfinished business, but to also set a new pathway for Bougainville. I will utilize the best brains available inside and outside Bougainville. I extend an olive branch to those who contested with me to come and work with me.
Mr. Toroama also took the opportunity in his acceptance speech to dismiss allegations made last week by John Momus of some candidates intimidating the voters. Support for the Toroama victory is strong, even among those candidates he defeated. The last person to be eliminated was Peter Chiamalili, who says the new leader has his full support. Mr. Chiamalili, who's now a businessman on Bougainville after heading the Papua New Guinea Sports Foundation, says he's happy with how he went and the outcome of the contest. He says the people have spoken, and it's up to everyone to now get behind the new president.
This is the leader that majority have put their mark on. I'm happy and I will support our new president. You know, in every competition, there can only be one winner, as they always say. And I remain positive in his statement, in his maiden statement. He said he's put out an olive branch to all those candidates that have ran in this presidential race. And I think that is a good gesture.
Peter Chiamalili was also critical of the Momus comments, saying if the retiring president had evidence of election fraud, he should have put it up before the public instead of airing his speculation in the international media. Part of Mr. Toroama's success was being able to show his battle scars to convince the people he's the one to lead them to independence. That's the view of another candidate in the presidential race, Sam Maiha. Mr. Maiha grew up alongside Ishmael Toroama, both of them the sons of Methodist ministers, trained by the same Tongan spiritual advisor.
There's some believe that God was with him and he's the one whom God has chosen to lead Bougainville. So he was a kind of a hero. He's got scars all over him and he didn't need that much to convince the people that he was the one leader who fought for the island and fought for them. And even to me, he's my hero too.
Sam Maiha called Mr. Toroama his brother and says he's ready and willing to help and advise him in his new role. Another candidate who exited early in the preference count, Martin Miriori, who counts himself as an ally of Mr. Toroama, says the win is hugely significant.
Leadership returning to the actual fighter, the freedom fighter. To me, I'm happy the mandate has been given to Ishmael because I think that it's going to signal a lot of things, especially in regard to the referendum vote. You will definitely bring with him a decisive leadership that we will need and the rest of us. All we can do is we can support him, especially the former BIG BRA side.
The PNG Prime Minister James Marape congratulated Mr. Toroama on his election. Mr. Marape said he looked forward to working with him to secure the outcome of the referendum. He indicated he'd meet the new president in the coming weeks to discuss the next steps of the independence process. Cordon Wiseman, Tene.
Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister says the government is working on a new category of passport for people who previously purchased honorary citizenship. In recent years, foreigners who purchased this class of citizenship have been able to obtain regular Vanuatu passports. But it's been brought to the government's attention that since they are not full Vanuatu citizens, their travel documents could be misleading at international borders. Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission says it's no longer issuing honorary citizenships. The Deputy Prime Minister of Vanuatu, Ishmael Kalsukau, spoke to Johnny Blades, who asked what will happen to those honorary citizens still holding regular passports.
My team have drawn up policy papers to deal with this issue in the form of a new passport that takes care of persons with honorary status, people who are here on economic or investment purposes to be afforded a categorization of passport. So it probably still remains. I'm not sure whether it's been taken out, but what I know for sure is it will change very soon.
So you're saying the categorization is going to be more clear?
More clear to safeguard the sanctity of original, if not having a citizenship by naturalization, to be characterized and be seen in different light than those who are seeking citizenship by way of investment.
So for those who may have purchased honorary citizenship over recent years, will they be upgraded to full citizenship?
Yes and no, because there are still the qualifications that are contained in the constitution that was amended to qualify aspects of citizenship, where if you're a citizenship by way of investment or honorary, you're not able to vote and you're not able to participate in local politics. But other than that, yes, it's as legitimate as citizenship.
As it is from recent years, and maybe 2 years ago, you bought honorary citizenship, and yet you've got the passport, which is no different to something that a full Ni Vanuatu national like yourself might show when coming, you know, entering or looking to enter another country. And that's potentially problematic, not just for them, but for Ni Vanuatu.
It is seriously problematic. That's why we've come up with this way out, so to speak, so that it actually protects the integrity of the green passport.
The way out is what, this categorization reconfiguration?
Yes, it's a sort of an economic passport, different in colour, but it gives the effect of citizenship that is prescribed under the constitution with those qualifications. You get the passport, but it's a different passport. It's going to be a yellow passport and not the green one. Clears up issues of integrity and sanctity.
Okay, so theoretically people who already have honorary citizenship might be transferred to that?
Yes, they will in due course, so as to clear up any confusion.
That was Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister Ishmael Kalsukau. Despite better awareness about mental health in New Zealand's Pacifica community, those on the front line say much more still needs to be done. It is Mental Health Awareness Week in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Koro Wakauta has been speaking to those who are ensconced in helping the community.
Jemima Teateasith is a public health researcher at Auckland University. She co-heads the School of Māori and Pacific Studies and was on the government's recent Mental Health and Addiction Inquiry. She says this week is a good reminder to keep an eye out for whānau.
Our family members, we're all going through some tough times, and ensuring that, you know, everyone has, I guess, some safe spaces and some people to lean on and reach out to and vice versa.
Dr. Teateasith says it's important people make themselves available.
You can't expect someone who isn't feeling too well to be able to do the reaching out. It's our responsibility as family members, as church members or teammates, to be able to identify those and our loved ones or our mates. So I think everyone's accountable and everyone should improve or increase their own mental health literacy around it.
Josiah Tula'ala-Mali'i was also part of the mental health inquiry. He says he's had his own struggles.
I got a $20,000 law scholarship when I finished school and things were going quite well, and then after a few really difficult months I ended up having to leave and because I was so unwell. It was my family and my psychologist who helped me work through what was going on.
Mr. Tuala Mali'i says he drew on that experience to help his work in the inquiry. He says recommendations related to Pasifika are still being worked on, albeit slowly.
This is about real people's lives. This is about real pain. This is about, you know, the mother who now has to go home and see her son is no longer with her because he's taken his life. This is about the family who are having to look after their loved one who is in deep pain and they can't speak to the pain that person has. Money gets spoken about or new ways of getting support, but really this has to be about real people, and so it does take time.
Denise Kingi Ula'ave from the Pasifika Mental Health Organisation Leva says there appears to be more sensitivity around mental well-being than a couple of decades ago. She says a lot has changed since she entered the sector as a clinical psychologist 20 years ago when it was rare to see Pasifika working in the field.
I was one of three Pacific clinical psychologists in the whole of New Zealand. Now that has grown to approximately 20. So this suggests that our families are more aware and accepting of the need and the value of having a career in this area.
Dr. Jemima Teteasith says things have improved, but a lot still needs to be done.
There are larger things at play. We know that systemically there's institutional racism, there's cultural incompetence, and all that type of stuff can work to the detriment of our people. And I think until we address some of the systemic issues, then we'll really see a shift. We can ask ourselves, what can Pacific peoples do for Pacific peoples? Basically, we need to ask, you know, our decision makers, what can you do for Pacific?
She says a key is nurturing resilience and providing self-determination for Pacific people to determine what well-being means to them. This is Koro Vakauta.
Still to come on Tangata o Te Moana, climate change prompts urgent delineation of countries' maritime boundaries in the region. Pacifica communities in small-town New Zealand want a greater voice, and a Pacific economist thinks COVID-19 has shown a way for a Pacific Super Rugby side to be viable. But first, China's development grants to Solomon Islands are a departure from its usual aid approach, according to Solomon Islands academic. Since the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries last year, Beijing has committed to building the main stadium and other sporting venues for the 2023 Pacific Games in Honiara, saying it is a gift. A political scientist at the University of Hawaii Manoa, Tarsisius Tarakabutaulaka, says concessional loans make up the bulk of almost all of China's existing international aid and development initiatives.
So at the moment, it's specific projects that they've promised, and that's what they are delivering on. And also, it is important to note that some of these projects, especially like the Pacific Games facility for 2023, were things that Taiwan had initially promised to assist the Solomons with. And the absence of Taiwan, China is stepping in and taking over these projects. And that's the biggest one. Apart from, you know, Chinese company investments in Solomon Islands, particularly like Gold Ridge. Although they've started and there was a big event that marked the beginning of that project, we haven't seen the actual delivery in terms of the export or the actual mining and then the export, which will take time. So one of the things that's interesting to me regarding China's assistance is that in cases that we've seen in the past, China tend to deliver its assistance in the form of concessional loans, mostly a small percentage, often in grants, but a huge amount of Chinese assistance has been in concessional loans. And we see that in other countries. We see it in Africa, in Asia, and so forth. But if we were to believe what the Chinese government and the Solomon Islands government are saying, then it seems that the assistance to Solomon Islands has largely been in the form of grant. And if that were true, then it means that there is a change in the way in which China is delivering its assistance, in this specific case to the Solomon Islands. But it'll be interesting to see how it's done to other countries as well. And then the next question is whether it is only this first part of the assistance that China is giving that's in the form of grants. And perhaps in the future, as the relationship is established and strengthened, some of those assistance will go back to what China usually does, which is in the form of concessional loans. So it'll be interesting to observe it over a period of time and see what's happening. What's the dynamic of this relationship?
Obviously, not everyone has fully drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, in terms of Chinese development. There's been a lot of ructions within the country. What do you think of the pushback against China, despite all the promises of development and support and as you say, grant at the moment?
Yeah, and we've seen that particularly played out in the relationship between Malay, the province, and the central government. And there were a lot of pushback prior to the establishment of the relationship, and that continues in some sector. I think, you know, there are a number of things at play here. One is that whether it is the relationship with China or with Taiwan, the international relations that is the main reason for this pushback, or whether there is domestic politics at play and people are using international relationship to give privilege and visibility to concerns that are very domestic in nature.
Solomon Islands academic Tarsisius Tara Kabutaulaka. For years, Pacific Island countries have questioned what would happen to their lucrative ocean fishing grounds should their islands be submerged by rising sea levels caused by climate change. Today, these same countries are being told to pursue the delineation of their maritime boundaries with urgency. The call was made last week at a regional conference on securing the boundary limits of the Bleak Pacific. The online meeting also explored legal options and institutional responses to the impacts of sea level rise on maritime zones. Christine Ravoy listened in and filed this report.
The Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat, Dame Meg Taylor, says securing the Blue Pacific continent against the threat of sea level rise is a defining issue for the region.
If we don't secure our regions, if what we want is not at our doorstep right away, then we are all working towards that through the science, but also through the legal avenues. And we have to secure this for the future generations.
Member states agree that climate change-induced sea level rise has posed a legal threat to the Pacific's maritime zone entitlements and statehood status under international law. Dame Meg says without the enjoyment of rights and jurisdictions in the Pacific's maritime zones, the protection of the region's heritage, economic development and nation building is not possible.
It's really important that where there are issues that need to be really thrashed out and technical advice that needs to be brought in, is to do that work and then ensure that we support the member states so that they have ownership of the process and that they are the ones that are leading this work.
At the core of it all is the question, can a country without land still be considered a country? And if not, then does the largest ocean in the world just lay claim to the exclusive economic zones of the countries it submerges? Tuvalu is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world when it comes to climate change and sea level rise. It has taken the lead in this regard, amending its legislation to show the breadth of its maritime zones are measured from a fixed baseline and are unchanging. Its Foreign Minister Simon Coffe says Tuvalu will insist its diplomatic partners recognize that position. Conference Chair and Tuvalu's Deputy Representative to the United Nations, Fakasoa Teale, says a subcommittee is being set up to provide legal advice to forum leaders on the tasks that lay ahead.
Through this endeavour, we can confidently point to a number of key legal options and strategies that are very much within our reach. We can focus on building our body of state and regional practice, which in turn will count towards a very strong and compelling set of evidence for shaping international law in this area.
The region's main scientific organization, the Pacific Community, says its role has been primarily technical and it has achieved a significant amount of work in the finalization of many country boundaries. But its Deputy Secretary General, Dr. Audrey Almua, says there are 13 more boundaries to finalize and this will take many years.
We will look at measurements and surveying work. We will often sit out on boats for many days and weeks. And we will assist our countries to actually undertake surveys to identify these particular boundaries. And this is outer coral reefs, inner coral reefs and so forth.
Dame Meg Taylor says the time is now right to leverage the geopolitical interests and opportunities that are available to the Pacific to advocate for and secure the region's maritime boundaries into perpetuity. Ko Kristen Ravoy, aho.
As part of RNZ's 2020 election coverage, we're looking at some of the communities who are part of the country's changing face and identity. Dominic Godfrey visited one of small town New Zealand's fastest growing Pacific communities in Oamaru, where around 200 families have moved in recent decades. Pacifica now make up 20% of the town's 13,000 people, compared to Auckland's 15%.
When Hana Fanene moved to Oamaru in the 1980s with her three siblings and mother, the young Samoan girl was a distinct minority in the Waitaki district town. Now, married with a Tongan husband, Hana Halelele is an established part of the community, elected as the district's first Pacific local body politician, who also sits on council's health and housing committees. She'd like to see more Pasifika families paying down mortgages instead of rent.
So we have a local Waitaki housing task force as part of council, as well, just to kind of investigate different opportunities for local families to whether they want to buy their own home. And there is a lot of need there, especially with our Pacific community, that are quite aspirational.
She wants collaboration between Waitaki District and central government to help Pacific families into their first homes. Affordable quality homes and ownership for Pasifika were a $41.3 million priority in this year's budget. But Hana Halelele says nothing's rolled out in Waitaki where homeowners are a minority.
It would be lovely to have at least 80-85% of our Pacific families in the next 5 to 8 years to be in their own homes, but we have to provide those opportunities for them to be able to reach those. And that includes supporting our local economy so people stay in good employment.
Housing's not the only issue. Silau Temwana, her husband and three sons, arrived 12 years ago seeking better opportunities. They're part of Oamaru's new and growing Tuvalu community of 200 people. Ms. Temwana says long work hours to cover the high cost of living, plus church and community obligations, meant they weren't achieving their goals in Auckland.
It's just becoming overwhelmed, and we have set goals for our families to achieve, you know, for our boys to grow up in an environment where education is a priority, which is something we didn't see in our Tuvalu community in those days.
Their second son is soon to join their eldest in Christchurch studying mechanical engineering, while the youngest, in year 12 at high school, has his sights set on the law. However, she says Waitaki is lacking the culturally responsive education programs available elsewhere.
I am on Board of Trustees for one of the high schools here, and that's one of the things that I'm still pushing. Yeah, and I'm trading carefully.
While her husband works in aluminium fabrication, Silau Temwana has three jobs in the disability sector, work skills training, and a new role as Pasifika COVID-19 coordinator. She says the pandemic's been tough on the community of nearly 3,000 people who mostly rely on work at the large export meat processing and wool spinning plants.
It's starting to show in terms of like decreased hours of working. For example, one of the meat factories still have 2 to 3 days working, not a full week. So they are struggling.
She says attempts to raise rental prices, now the government's mandated freeze is over, have added to the stress. The Waitaki Tongan community president, Tuavale Misiloi, says there's a strong focus on getting good jobs. She wants to see a continuation of free trades training from any incoming government.
I saw that video about the offer a free apprenticeship for our people, which is really good to have that and encourage our children to go that way as well, because it's free, you know, but they get good jobs in the future.
Another in the Tongan community, Atela Asi, would like better access to healthcare that's culturally sensitive to Pacific people, and she wants cheaper providers.
Because in Auckland, they only pay $10 to see a GP.
How much is it here?
Here, you pay $40 to see a GP. And that's why I think a lot of Tongans, they don't go to GP. They come to emergency department in the hospital because it's free.
Aside from desired improvements in access to healthcare, pathways to home ownership, job security and investment in culturally appropriate education, the community's committed to advancing Waitaki District and their contribution to it. Ko Dominic Godfrey, tēnei.
Two senior executives at the University of the South Pacific could face censure and possible disciplinary action from the institution's governing body. Pro-Chancellor Winston Thompson and Chair of the Audit and Risk Committee Mahmoud Khan have been accused of undermining the USB Council and its authority. Last week, the USB Chancellor, Nauru President Lionel Angyemer, called for a special council meeting to consider measures against both men. Christine Ravoy has more.
In a press conference on the 11th of September, Winston Thompson had said he accepted the council's decision to exonerate Vice-Chancellor Professor Paul Alwalia. But he has since claimed there is a disconnect between the council and the university management. Both Mr. Thompson and Mahmoud Khan had accused Professor Alwalia of malpractice. But Mr. Thompson also claims the university has been besotted by a continuing crisis in governance since January last year.
The management is not fulfilling its responsibilities to the governing body. And this is causing consequential strains and has obviously a negative impact on the reputation of the university.
Mr. Khan says he's not happy at the decision by the council to exonerate Professor Alwalia and he wants an independent investigation into the allegations against the Vice-Chancellor.
They form their own committee, not independent, but of their own members and start an investigation. I don't know what the result of this 3 or 6 member team that they had appointed came up with.
But President Angyemer has accused both men of campaigning to remove the Canadian academic since the professor's appointment last year. In June, Professor Alwalia, who is also university president, was suspended by the executive committee led by Mr. Thompson. But the Kenya-born academic was reinstated after weeks of protests by students and staff when the University Council, which includes most of the region's governments, ruled due process had not been followed. The USB Staff Union's Ilima Finiasi says the decision by the council has put an end to what he described as an 18-month witch hunt by Mr. Thompson and the executive committee.
Professor can go back to what he is hired to do, that's to lead USB. We believe that during this time he was not able to pursue what exactly the university wanted him as the VC, because most of the time he's trying to defend himself, so now he can be allowed to carry on his work. So we're looking forward to Professor Alwalia carrying the university forward.
Professor Alwalia says it had been a difficult and challenging time. But now he says he's moving forward to ensure students are able to get the best possible education.
I'm really pleased, first of all, to be exonerated. I am a person of faith, and I think that's what's got me through since January 2019. Of course, it's been something that difficult that I've had to bear this additional burden defending myself at a time when my tension and everything should be focused on building a strong and resilient university, especially given the challenges of COVID.
The convening of the special council meeting is being supported by the Marshall Islands, Tuvalu, Tonga, New Zealand, Australia, Professor Alwalia, USB Senate Representative Professor Surendra Prasad, USB Staff Representative Dr. Robin Harvea, co-opted member Semi Tukana, and student representatives Joseph Sua and Viliame Naulivo. Under the USB Council rules, the meeting has to be convened before the 28th of September. Ko Christine Ravoy, aho.
An eminent Pacific economist thinks COVID-19 has shown the way that a Pacific Super Rugby side could be viable. Fijian academic Dr. Wadan Nasi, who for many years was teaching at the University of the South Pacific, is a long-time advocate for a Pacific team in the Super Rugby competition. His comments come amid a flurry of interest from various groups claiming to have the wherewithal to field a Pacific Island team in the competition. Nasi accepts the previous arguments that the Pacific Islands might struggle to sustain a team, but he told Don Wiseman that COVID-19 has changed that.
I know that over the years, the argument by Super Rugby administrators have been, can it be financially viable for them to have home games, you know, for the Pacific Islands, given the small audiences there and their limited capacity to pay reasonable fees to watch? So it's a very valid argument. But now I can see that this COVID-19 has encouraged people to be having home games and so on in countries other than where they come from. So I can see that it's a really strong possibility that the commercial people who are now putting up this proposal from Fiji, they are looking at the possibility of basing the Pacific Island team in New Zealand or Australia. And I suspect it will be New Zealand initially, where the home games will basically be in Auckland. And of course, you know, you've got very large, you know, Pacific Island population. So that commercially, these games will really be very, very viable.
One of the big issues is just what it costs to set one of these teams up. And of course, they've also got to have the facilities back home, don't they? Even if they're only going to play the occasional game.
Yes, I think that the Pacific Island countries are very much aware now of the economic value of being part of the Super Rugby franchise. And I think all the governments are going to, you know, dip into their pocket and upgrade the facilities they have, probably close to where the airports are, to make sure that they have got good grounds where the teams from abroad can come and play. And have no doubt that when there is a home game being played in Tonga or Samoa or Fiji, you'll get large numbers of the diaspora coming back to their home territories, watch the game amongst their own family members. And I've always believed that if you look at the relations between Australia and New Zealand and the Pacific, rugsport is one of the most powerful binding agents that our governments have. And they haven't made full use of it. And, you know, in the decade where all the politicians in Australia and New Zealand are really concerned about superpowers muscling in, well, sport is an area where you can bind themselves to the Pacific so closely that no superpower will be able to dislodge them.
Fijian academic Dr. Wada Nasi. And that's Tangata o Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. There's more on our website. Just head over to rnz.co.nz and click on the Pacific tab. Leana.